from Burnaby Mountain. This is CJSF 90.1 reminding you to stay safe and that through Campus Community Radio, you can let CJSF 90.1 listeners know about an important community event or a public service. Email your information to cjsfpsa@sfu.ca. That was cjsfpsa@sfu.ca. Let us know the where, the when, and the how, and we can take it from there. We would love to help your community service have a wider public engagement. Remember, email cjsfpsa@sfu.ca.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Over the years, Mark Nepo has written about awakening, risk, courage, listening, and grace. He says he writes in order to grow. Each of us have our own unique ways to keep us on the path of our spiritual growth. If we allow the path of our seeking some room, if we don't hold the reins of our life too tightly, we'll be drawn to what we need in order to live a more awakened and enlivened life. This is the subject of today's conversation with our guest, Mark Nepo. Mark Nepo is a poet and philosopher who over three decades has been teaching in the fields of poetry and spirituality. As a cancer survivor, Mark remains committed to the usefulness of daily inner life. He devotes his writing and teaching to the journey of inner transformation and the life of relationship. He's the author of 17 books, including Reduced to Joy, 7,000 Ways to Listen, Staying Close to What is Sacred, and The One Life We're Given, Finding the Wisdom That Waits in Your Heart. He also has many audio learning courses available, including Staying Awake and Holding Nothing Back. Join us for the next hour as we explore crafting the life of the soul through engaging with life with our guest, Mark Nepo. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you again.
It's so great to have you and to be sitting with you once more, Mark. First of all, I want to say this newest book, I want to tell our listeners. I mean, I go through the books before I and prepare for an interview, as many of you know. But this one, I felt so rushed, even though I spent days with it. I felt rushed. I felt that it is a kind of book, and you know I don't say this very often, but this is a kind of book, or would I say conversation more than a book, that I could spend years with.
Well,
and
I
intend to spend years with it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. I'm very touched. Yeah.
Well, it was my honor and privilege to have this in my life now. Yes. So I'd like to say, you know, in understanding what truly sustains us, We think of our job, or we think of getting money, or we think of even our health or the food on our table. And even though these are very important in our lives, what would you say that we're here for, that our soul's purpose that is beyond just this maintenance?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, our career is awakening the soul. Where that happens is our occupation. And where that happens changes, because we are dynamic, changing human beings, being spirits and bodies in time on earth. We never stay the same. And I think, over time, my experience, of course, no one knows. Let's first say that we're just comparing notes. I don't have any answers. And we're all just making guesses. But, you know, one of my guesses through all this time, my time on earth, is that the soul wants nothing more than for us to be as alive as possible. Just the way, you know, of the purpose of a fire is to burst into flame and give off light and heat. Well, and let's even take that further. Let's look at the sun. The sun, when it is fully itself, which it always is, it doesn't have anything mitigating on that. The sun emanates light and warmth in every direction, holding nothing back without preference. I believe that our soul is our inner sun. And every one of us is born emanating light and warmth in every direction when we hold nothing back without preference. Now, this doesn't mean, because we do live, as you mentioned, we live in the world of circumstance. We live in a surface world of events where we have to make choices and problem solve. But that light within us continues to shine and emanate in all directions without preference. And this is part of the challenge of living the one life we're given. Because very often I find, and in my own life, I know these things because I do them all the time. Just because we have knowledge doesn't mean we're exempt from stumbling through this incarnation, you know. So I know a lot about these things because I violate them all the time. So, but, you know, I may be in a friendship with you and maybe something happens and I feel hurt. And so I'm not sure how I continue to trust you. Okay?
That happens.
And that happens all the time. Now, often we can move through that. So I have to make choices in the relational world, choices in the surface world. How do I discern what's trustworthy? How do I regain trust? How do I restore trust? But often in protecting myself earlier in life, what I've mistakenly done is shut off that light as if that will protect me. I've muffled that light. Whereas the only way through pain and distrust and hurt and betrayal and the thousand things, cuts and nicks we go through being alive, is to never stop having the soul and the heart, like the sun, emanate its aliveness in all directions without preference.
That's beautiful. And I'm thinking it's like you alluded to something. It's like this journey that we're on. And in this culture, we're taught that, to problem solve and to arrive at something. And I think in the conversation, in what you've written in all of these vignettes in this new book, The One Life We're Given, you talk about how it's the journey, it's not the arrival. And sometimes that's troubling to us because we want to kind of be there. We want to be enlightened and arrive, and now we know.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that we find out, and, you know, Adyashanti, who's a wonderful contemporary teacher. I love this line Adya has in one of his books that says, you know, eventually, if we're lucky, I'm paraphrasing, the spiritual journey will exhaust the seeker so that we can find that everything is right where we are. And so, you know, I personally, and again, I can only speak from my own experience, but, you know, I don't believe in an arrived state of enlightenment. I believe that this amazing, messy, and magnificent incarnation of being human is the state of carrying a light within and just as, you know, as I'm talking to you, my hands are expanding and contracting. I'm inhaling and exhaling. My eyes are blinking and the heart and mind open and close continually. So, you know, we're awake and then we fall asleep and we're sensitive and then we're numb and we're safe and then we're afraid. So the spiritual journey is one of return, of constant return. Because we will get lost and we will fall down and then we have to get up and we will, you know, be sensitive and then we'll be numb. And today I'll save you and tomorrow I'll hurt you. And so it's the humble journey of discovering our own practice of return. And I, you know, so I feel like there's really nowhere to go. But this brings me to the other thing you mentioned, that, you know, it upsets us not to think that there's nowhere to arrive. Or, and I think that, and I'm starting to understand this. I'm just turned 65. I'm starting to understand after many years some, the dynamic or the spiritual physics, if you will, of having dreams and goals and ambitions. And I think we're taught at an early age to hold on to them too tightly. They are, in fact, not endpoints, but kindling for the fire of our aliveness. We are a mix of being and becoming. There's nothing wrong with becoming, but it's like having two legs to walk. We need to be and become, or having two eyes to see. With only one eye, there's no depth. There's no depth perception. So we do need both, but I feel like, you know, we learn what brings us alive, and then someone tells us, oh, You seem to come alive when you put your hands in the earth. Mm-hmm. You should become a gardener.
Right. You know, it reminds me of a story that you have in the book, and this is a bicyclist.
Great. Let me share that quickly here. So there is a cyclist who's training very hard for a race that is like the Tour de France, very demanding and serious and professional. He has all the equipment. He's shaved the hair off his body to lower resistance when he's riding quickly into the wind. And so the day of the race comes, he's trained for months, and it's out in the country, and off they go. And sure enough, he's ahead. And in fact, he's so far ahead after the first mile or so that they're coming over a hill, and briefly, you can't see the other cyclists. That's how far ahead he is. And as he's coming down to the bottom of the hill, just as he's coming to the bottom of the hill, a great blue heron with its wings fully spread sweeps over his handlebars. And it stuns him. It stops him. He literally stops and straddles his bike because the heron opened something he was chasing. And the other cyclists are catching up. And now we move years forward. And he's standing on his back porch looking out toward the sunset. And once in a while, if you ask him, he might, when you say to him, what cost you the race? Once in a while, he might say, I didn't lose the race. I left it. And so at the heart of this story, because, you know, someone very practical could say, well, that's a very poetic story. That's
and
very
he
nice.
He was ambitious. He uses ambition to train himself.
Right. And you know what? He lost the race. He did lose the race. But I hold it differently because I think he trained to meet the heron. And if you told him he was training to meet a heron, he wouldn't have trained. And so many of our goals and dreams and ambitions are valuable as stepping stones to a mystery yet to unfold for us. And so often when we work toward our dreams, often our dreams don't come true, but by giving our all to them, sometimes we come true.
Ah.
And that's more important.
I'm here with Mark Nepo. He's the author of The One Life We're Given, Finding the Wisdom That Waits in Your Heart. And you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website. He has so many wonderful things on his website, Mark Nepo, N-E-P-O, marknepo.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. My guest is Mark Nepo. He's the author of The One Life We're Given, Finding the Wisdom That Waits in Your Heart. And Mark, yeah, I would like to, for you to share a little bit about what you learned from your father. Your father, he was a woodworker, and also he was a sailor. He had a sailboat, and you would sail with him. So talk about some of the gifts that you got from your father.
Well, you know, my father died about 3 years ago at 93, and he was a great creative force, and he was a very gifted man with his hands. He was a master woodworker, as you said, and he loved the sea. So he built a 30-foot ketch that I spent a lot of time on as a young man, as a young boy. And it's interesting that now, after all these years and after he's gone, you know, I am triggered to remember different things that I don't know that he was aware he was teaching, and I certainly wasn't aware I was learning. But now I understand in the context of my life now. And my father was very intelligent, and he read a lot, but he was a very literal man. He read a lot of history and nonfiction, and of course he gets a mystical poet for a son. And so, you know, we never quite spoke the same language, but I'm realizing after all these years and that I work an awful lot like him. You know, he had a workshop in his basement. He taught at Brooklyn Tech High School in New York City, and then at night and on the weekends he would just be down there, just so happy to be creating and building things. But he had an L bench in the basement, and there were five or six vices all along, and each one had a different project in it. So he might glue one piece and let it set, and then go here and plane another, and then go over here and glue something else together or piece something. And so he was always working. And, you know, as a little boy, I would just watch him, like sit on the stairs, basement stairs, and watch him. And it's all these years later that I realized that's how I work on books.
Mm.
I've always worked on more than one book at the same time. And they kind of cross-pollinate, and I go with one, and I might work on one for a few weeks, and then it'll lead me over to this one, and then it'll lead me to research, or then it'll lead me here. And then usually at one point, a book like this one will have enough of aliveness in it that it will demand that I spend my time with it until it's birthed. But that's usually how it happens. And it's also, you know, my father had a wood pile that was really just full of fragments. Like, he never wasted any wood. So if he would cut off an excess piece and he wasn't sure it was big enough to do something with, but he wasn't sure what, he'd throw it in the pile so that when he had other projects he was working on, he might be able to take that piece and make use of it. And when my father died, there must have been, my brother and I looked for him in that wood bin, you know, and there must have been 500 pieces of wood just.
Right.
And I realize now, again, after he's gone, that is also how I work, because I have fragment folders.
Right.
So, you know, I don't really, you know, not one of the, this ties in with our other story about the cyclist, because not one of the books I've written is the book I started.
Just like, not he didn't one. Win the race,
right.
But he certainly was successful. In
not one. And what that means is that by following, and this pertains not just to my writing, but to the terrain that this book opens, by following the aliveness, I discover the wisdom that waits in my heart. And for me, it's through the process of this inquiry or this conversation, the trail of which are the words, are the books, you know. But the way that I work, which I never would have imagined years ago, is that, you know, as a poet, I encounter, and I'm always encountering what the Hindus call the Upa Guru. Now, the Upa Guru means the teacher that is next to you at this moment. Isn't that a great
That's
phrase?
Beautiful. That's beautiful.
Upa Guru, UPAGURU. And so this is another way to understand the moments peak moments, the moments that speak to us, that come alive. So from a very early age, you know, the wind through the trees might be speaking to me of a pattern, and so I might jot that down, or I might overhear a conversation in a cafe, or see the light, you know, on a spider web on a building, or who knows what. And then I don't know necessarily where they go or what they mean, but they become my teachers, so I have to work with them. And so what I'll do is I will record them, I'll write them down, and then I'll put them in this fragment folder. And then over time, when I start to work on something like this book, then I go through that fragment folder and I see, were any of those teachers waiting for now? Did any of them belong? Did they come to me then so that I could learn from them now? And then sure enough, the light through that spider web is just how the light of love goes through all the unseeable connections between people. And what does that have to do with the one life we're given? I would never, and if I hadn't have saved it, if I hadn't have trusted, even though I didn't know what it meant when I first saw it, I wouldn't, and all of this tells us that what? That learning from life takes time.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time. And in a culture, you know, I love technology. There's nothing wrong with technology. Technology's inert. But if we don't have inner values, then the characteristics of technology will be our default values, the same way that water will fill any hole. It's like gravity, not because technology is evil. So if I don't develop an inner curiosity or wonder or willingness to be patient and learn over time, then the instantaneous characteristic of technology will by default become how I operate in the world.
Right, and I'm thinking too that there is a, you know, when the way news comes to us, and you've written about this, that, you know, it's old news in 10 minutes. I mean, it's just thrown away. And you talk about how news really reports on the circumstances. But it's these conversations. It's the stories that we tell one another that really enlivens us to meaning.
Yes. So, you know, news tends to cover, yes, the surface circumstance. But it's story and question that reveal the meaning that's inherent in relationship. And without that meaning, life is not bearable.
There's something I just loved in your book. It was so great, and I'm going to use it in my circles. And it's something you talk about, in the deep questions we ask one another, it's called
Idae,
and that's a Portuguese word.
Yes.
And I love this, that when we hear a story from one another, there's something else that you're suggesting we do.
So this comes from my dear friend David, who is a doctor and a researcher, and he's working in one of the leaders in global work around eliminating worm-based diseases in all of the world in children. But David was in Brazil, and in the Portuguese language there, in the indigenous people, there's a custom, this Edaí. Edaí, I think it's Edaí. I might have mispronounced it the first. Edaí. And it's beautiful. There's so many of these amazing anonymous teachings that come down if we just take the time to look for them. So what Edaí means is, and so? And in a folk way, as a way for people to be elders to each other, to be companions to each other, it's asked often in three ways. So if you come to me and you have a problem, you're heartbroken, or a flood has ruined your home, or who knows what has happened to you, but you're in some difficulty. So, you know, you tell me what happened. And the first, I listen, and respectfully, my first, I say, Edaí. And the first Edaí is the largest. It means, and so, in the context of all of life. What do you think this means? Not, oh, this is don't, you know, this is insignificant. Your trouble's insignificant given all of existence.
It's not denying it.
No, it's a question. It's saying, okay, yes, you're in this problem and it's painful. What, and so, what does it mean in the largest context of all of life? And then I would listen to you explore that. And then I would say, Edai again. Edai, and so. And the second time it's asked, it means, okay, because Edai literally means, and from here. So it means the second time, and so, from where you're standing, where is the next solid footing? From, given all of what you just described, from where you're standing, where is the next piece of solid ground?
And you're not necessarily meaning, okay, well, I lost my house, I'm going to go to the bank.
No.
It's not that.
No, that's totally open for the person to reveal their own wisdom. By asking this, you are asking the person, so tell me where you're standing is not solid. Look around you. When does land, the ground around you, become solid next? And so then you would explore that with me. And then my final Edai would be, Edai, and so what is your next step?
Yeah.
What is your next step? So this is a powerful indigenous anonymous wisdom of relationship that is really like spiritually practical. It's a beautiful thing that you can try. I offer an exercise in there to actually try this with something you're going through. And notice the person asking the question is not giving any advice.
Right.
Is not telling the person where to go or what to do, but simply helping them diagnose and discern what you're going through. I don't want to minimize it. Let's legitimize it. It's serious. It's difficult. And what does it mean in the context of all of life?
Right. I can see where it enlarges the whole conversation, because we often are with one another and we hear something from another and we witness one another, and that's a good thing to do. But this takes it a step further in my mind and in my experience of just, you know, understanding what you're saying.
Well, it's a beautiful, you know, if you remember the great sociologist Ivan Illich in the 1960s, and toward the end of his life, in an interview, he was asked to speak about spiritual hospitality, which he defined as helping another cross a threshold. And I love that.
Yes.
Because it doesn't, you're not telling the person what the threshold is. You're not telling them how to cross it. You're simply helping them. And this practice is one way to do that.
Exactly. Exactly. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with teacher, poet, philosopher, Mark Nepo, and his most recent book is The One Life We're Given, Finding the Wisdom That Waits in Your Heart. And he has like 16 other books, so you may want to just check them all out. And I want to remind you that I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe